The Breakfast Club.
Adam White. Whitey, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you.
You said that Novak Djokovic isn't playing. Yeah, what's he doing?
My understanding is there's been an incident.
Really?
Yes, yes. You may or may not have come across this information. You are busy with lots of stuff outside of sport and news, but I can tell you that Novak won't be playing,
right.
Won't be looking for career Grand Slam number 21 to break the record here in Victoria.
But I saw him practicing on the centre court.
He was.
He seemed to be in good spirits and was hitting the ball well. He's not playing.
He's not playing.
Huh.
It's a sad day. Or is it?
What a circus. What a circus.
What were you going to say?
What a shame, I think, for the Australian Open that at least the last week has been completely overshadowed by a lack of leadership. From somebody, or maybe some people, to prevent that from just completely overshadowing the last week, the whole build-up for the Australian Open tennis, which, there's so many good stories that we should be talking about in the build-up to it all. What Thanasi Kokkinakis did last week.
Yes.
The fact that Ash Barty, the undisputed number one player in the world, is hopefully going to win her home Grand Slam. There's so many of them, and it was all about Novak.
In fairness, in terms of a build-up, there's nothing worse than making stories up in the build-up to something. We've talked about this before with the Olympics and
absolutely.
All that sort of stuff. Big events, and you're just filling column inches and filling seconds on the radio with talking about stuff that really, grand scheme of things, no one cares about. We want to talk about the action. Because then the stories come from the action.
Yeah, so I agree with that. I agree with that.
So, but at least there's been some coverage. Like, the whole world knows the Australian Open's
that's
on.
Right.
There's a positive here, Whitey.
That's right. But that is true. But I think the Australian Open, it is actually about the month of January when it comes to tennis. It has always been about, whether it was in the past, the Hopman Cup or the Sydney International or, they have the one hardcore championships up in Brisbane. There was always stories through that month.
Yeah.
And then culminating in the Australian Open, where people that were stars for the first 2 weeks of January, they're bundled out in the first round. And it's kind of like, oh, well, but you had a good week a couple of weeks ago. And you know what I mean? Like, it's not just that 2 weeks of the Australian Open.
But I suppose with this build-up being, or the calendar being COVID-affected, it sort of takes a little bit of the jam out of that donut anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Normally, is there that calendar of events leading up to this week, the next 2 weeks? But we haven't had that as it historically has been.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this the other day, and because I know you've talked about this a lot, just about how cluttered that summer schedule is now for all sports, that it kind of isn't. January isn't kind of the month for tennis now because you've got the Big Bash on every night. You've got the cricket that, has gone a little bit later when it comes to the test matches compared to other years. You've got the AFLW starting. You've got A-League going on. You've got basketball. I mean, there's so much going on that you sort of find yourself trying to get a bit of everything rather than January being tennis.
So have you been getting a bit of everything, or have you been shutting down and just building up to this very moment where
that's
the world
the 17th
starts
of January.
Again?
That's right.
Because I must admit, my interest or consumption, perhaps, not interest, consumption, perhaps, of the latest sports news in the last month has been not quite as up to speed as it perhaps would have been through February to November.
Yeah, no, mine's pretty much been chock-a-block. No, I mean, obviously, for me and for our family, it's all about the cricket, so... Yeah, the Big Bash has been on every night.
Still going, isn't it?
There's probably been more interest for us at home in the Big Bash than there has been in the Test Series because the Test Series has been so uncompetitive. But it's just cricket.
Actually, what do you reckon about the Test Series? Give us a call, 1-300-652-927. Uncompetitive is the word Whitey just used. 0416-90-50-52 via the SMS as well. Because I was thinking about that last night and my... It's been uncompetitive, but England have been spineless. Spineless. And I don't use that term lightly just for grandstanding. Inside 7 sessions in Melbourne and inside 9 sessions in Hobart. And all out for 56 effectively yesterday from the first wicket to the end of the collapse. They have been nothing short of, spineless is the word I've come to rest on. It's been a series that is not worthy of the history of this rivalry.
It's not, but it's... I'm not surprised by what I saw over the 5 test matches. Because history says that they're not very good when they come to this country in the last decade. So it was 4-0 last time, 4-0 this time. If it didn't rain in Sydney, it would have been 5-0. I mean, Pat Cummins declared too late in Sydney to give Khawaja the opportunity to make 100 and maybe Cameron Green. But if there was no rain, they would have won that one too.
Yeah.
Even you go back 8 years ago, they won 5-0. So it's they're just not good enough. And I think that I would have loved for them to have shown more spine last night and at least forced it into a fourth day, and maybe even if they had four wickets in hand, netting 100 or something like that. But I think they want to go home.
That's an acceptable outcome, though. Like, you're a professional cricketer. You can't just want to go home. You play your series for your nation, and sometimes we mock that a little bit about playing for your country and all that sort of stuff. But you're representing your nation. Yes, it's in cricket, and it's not, grand scheme of things, it's not saving the world. But to have that little gumption and fight in the last, Melbourne and Hobart particularly, and as you say, should have been a white walk in Sydney, whitewash in Sydney as well. I just think it's been utterly disappointing.
I agree with you 100%, but I also just don't think they're very good. In December at some point, I did the England Lions game versus Australia A.
You did?
And the England Lions in their first innings were bowled out for 100. And I got to see very closely what's the next best, and they're terrible. They just don't have the players. Now, Joe Root is a class above everybody else, but he suffers by not having good players around him. He carries the world on his shoulders, so he can't bat with the same sort of freedom that he would like to be able to bat with. And maybe when they're playing weaker opposition at home, he can relax a bit more, and he obviously gets a lot of runs. But they just don't have the players. There has been such a focus there on white ball cricket over a fairly long period of time. Now they've got to be congratulated for that, because it won them a World Cup. That's right. So it's not like it hasn't reaped any sort of benefits at all. But when it comes to they've destroyed their own county championship with the 100 and the NatWest Blast, more of a focus on that. And
as I said, two limited overs, limited overs competitions is a joke.
And this is, it's probably a warning also for Australia that they've got to be a little bit careful with what they do with the Sheffield Shield when it comes to the Big Bash, because maybe they're 5 years ahead of where we are. I don't necessarily think they are, but they've got to be careful.
I want to hear what Michael Vaughan had to say at the end of the test match last night. I remember listening to it live and thought, oh, that's worth playing tomorrow on the Breakfast Club. Let's have a listen to Michael Vaughan on Fox Sports.
Yeah, Australia just too good for England, but I have to say, this has been embarrassing. When you see an England side throwing in the towel, and that's what they've done in the last hour, they've just thrown the towel, and it's been a long tour, it's been difficult. The Australians too powerful, too strong, too much expertise, too much quality. But I just can't accept when I see an England side throw the towel in.
Long conversations will be held, no doubt about that, about the structure of English cricket on the back of it. Started a couple of tests ago, and no doubt it'll be fairly forensically analysed after this performance too.
And, half the thing that is the most disappointing part of the entire series was Australia aren't that good.
Well, this is, I want to get to this.
Yeah, so when you look at the Australian lineup, let's just look at the top seven. So we won't worry about the bowlers, because they're world class, and they have been for a long time, and they proved that. But the top seven, going into the series, there was only two players that had played more than 20 test matches, which was Steve Smith and David Warner. Now, both of them had modest series. Warner started okay, got rattled by Mark Wood and never really got it going again after that. And Steve Smith, well, that's a whole conversation to have at another time. But Australia's batting wasn't good. And then when you lose Hazelwood after the first test match, you lose Travis Head, who was so good in Brisbane, but lose him to COVID. You lose Pat Cummins from the second test, and you lose your captain before the whole thing started in Tim Payne. They didn't have the best of build-ups, or they didn't necessarily have a lot of things that went their way through the series either. Yet that team was able to be so dominant against England than when last year, when they had no real excuses, they couldn't beat an understrength Indian team. It really is interesting just how it's come across like Australia are so good, but really it's just how bad England are.
Craig and Mount Martha wants to have his say on the world of cricket. Great to have you with us, Craig. Good morning.
Morning, boys, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things. I wanted to quickly talk about the cricket, but now you mentioned Hal Warson winning the Standish Handicap Saturday. Well, That was just another thing I wanted to say.
Did we mention that?
I'm sure you mentioned that off the top. It was, I can't remember whether it was the 50 to 1, 2 start to go or Saturday. But anyway, that's another story.
I actually backed it too. It was very handy.
Well done, yeah. So did a few of my friends, thank goodness. I just wanted to mention about the English. I really felt for Sir Ian Botham at the end of the broadcast. He said a few things. He was literally disgusted with the whole thing. And you know, to see those last 2 or 3 wickets get thrown away, it was almost like we had enough, we're out of there.
Yeah.
That was the feeling that I got. And for all of those first-grade cricketers out there that looked at that, have probably thought, oh, this is really embarrassing, even as an Australian. So, yeah, look, I think Joe Root will probably throw the towel in, and I reckon they'll have a total rebuild from the ground up. That's my opinion.
Well, the future of Joe Root will be interesting, what they do with him, Craig. Good point.
Yeah, well, Joe Root has said even last night that he wants to be part of that rebuild and he wants to captain the team through that period. And I don't think they've got another option. I don't think Joe Root is a particularly good captain. He's an excellent batsman. But, gee, you can look bad as a captain when you haven't got the players around you. You can have all the great plans in the world,
but
if you haven't got the people to execute them.
As someone said off the SMS, and it's a very, very well-made point, England selectors blew it from the start, not playing Anderson and Broad in that first test up in the Gabba.
You know what? That
was
really,
a horrible
situation.
The way they've put the team together was horrible.
That really annoyed me because there's two things that happened in that first test match. I know we're going all the way back to the start of December, but they didn't pick their best team, and when they had the opportunity to use the conditions to their advantage with the team that they had and bowl first, they decided to bat first. And I reckon the only reason they batted first was because they were so worried about Nasser Hussain doing it all those years before that they couldn't risk that same thing happening to them. So they thought they were almost like forced into a corner to bat. The only chance England had was to start the series well. They chose not to play their best team in the first test match and chose not to take the most of the conditions in the first test match.
How do you leave out Broad and Anderson? Like, what planet are they on?
Because they were
on Dave Warner, and it's been well published, not just my idea. Dave Warner saying Stuart Broad with a new rock at the Gabba on the first day. Like, there's a little bit of poo in the pants.
No doubt. But this is the thing, Half, is that all they were worried about was the second test match before they'd played the first test match. So they get a green top in Brisbane. They go, you know what, if we play Anderson and Broad, even if Broad's a little bit underdone, and we put them in, we get Warner out cheaply because that's what Broad does, and all of a sudden Australia are 3 for 40, we might be a bit of a chance. But no, let's worry about the second test match under lights where the ball might swing for us.
Second first, same as the first.
Probably hard to put into words, like super excited. So happy. Me personally didn't see this coming 2 months ago, so over the moon.
Scotty, 18 wickets at 9.6. Can you believe what's happened to you in the last 3 weeks?
Not at all. Yeah, obviously in Melbourne it was pretty surreal, and then even today I think we took something like 9 for 40 in an hour and a half, so it's been great.
And Scotty, how does it feel to, after 3 test matches, to be a cult hero in Australia already in your career?
Oh, it's nice. Every time I've gone down the boundary, I've had so much support. The kids have been loving it, been getting extra selfies with them, so it's been great.
The voice of Scott Boland, the Ashes cult hero who made his debut. His home track at the MCG, 6 for 7, was a fairly handy way to go about his opening spell or opening test performance. As you heard Michael Vaughan say there in the audio from Fox Sports, 18 wickets. He was a bit disrespectful. He said 18 at 9.6. It was actually 18 at 9.55.
You round up the five.
Not when you got that level of excellence. An economy rate of 2.11. 31 overs were maidens of his 81. So almost, you know, 3 of 8. What's that, 36%, 37% of his overs were maidens. Quite remarkable, the appearance of Scott Boland at international level.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really rapt that they gave him that opportunity in Melbourne because the way that the pitch was presented was just perfect for Scott Boland. And that's what he has been doing at state level at the MCG for a long time. Even when the pitch wasn't as bowler-friendly as it was for Boxing Day this year, he's always been that person that just hammers just short of a length, gets the ball to move both ways, particularly away from the left-hander, and he bowls at a really good economy rate. And so he creates so much pressure with what he does. Now, sometimes he gets the wickets, sometimes the wickets come at the other end, but he's a fantastic partnership bowler. But no one could have imagined he would do what he was able to do.
No, that was unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it just, how many times do we see the England players nick and the Australian players miss outside off stump? Yeah. And it seems to happen a lot. Even if you think back to when India were dismissed so cheaply at Adelaide Oval last year, just every ball took the edge. Mm. And then when Australia batted, it missed the edge. It just, I don't know. But I think that might have something to do with the lengths that the tourists bowl compared to perhaps what the Australians do. I'm not sure. But no, I mean, it's a great story for someone that has persevered with his cricket for such a long period of time. He's unfashionable. He's not the best of fielders, but he'd admit that. He hasn't got that sort of dynamism that, say, Michael Nisa might have in the field, or certainly a Pat Cummins. But when it's his turn to bowl, he does his job. And when it's his turn to bat, as he proved in courageous terms on that second night in Hobart, he does the job. He does it for Victoria. He did it for Australia.
We played 7 fast bowlers.
Yes.
There's only a spot for 3.
Yep.
In any test match, the way it's configured now, with Cam Green doing his thing through the middle order and Nathan Lyon spinning his way to magic, although we didn't get too many from Nathan this time around. Got 16, I suppose. Did a pretty decent job. What does it look like going forward?
I still think the
Australian fast bowling attack.
I'll answer that 2 ways. I think, firstly, I still think the best 3 are Stark, Cummins and Hazlewood. And I think it's that combination as well. Stark with the left arm, Hazel with the seam, Cummins with the just the all-round excellence. I think the 4th ranked is Richardson, and then I think it's Boland and then Nisa. I still think that's... And that would have been the order for me before the series started, and I still think it's the same. But I think what will happen moving forward is that there will be that pitching staff-type philosophy to how they select teams. They go to Pakistan, they're feather beds, they'll suit batting. They'll probably have to rotate the bowlers around. I just don't think we're going to see series moving forward where the same 3 just bowl all the time. I think that's got to change, that mentality, because it didn't work for them against India last summer. And we've got such high quality bowling now, they have the luxury to be able to rotate it around a bit more.
Off the SMS, England selectors blew it from the start, as we picked up before. And both of them on Channel 7 labelled it gutless. There's another one. And this one, be fair, we produced 5 bowlers' wickets. No batsman had a great series from Krasa. So there was no real standard, although Travis Head was named player of the series for his performance, 2 centuries throughout the 5-test series.
From 4 matches and coming back into the team having had COVID and doing what he did. Look, it was would have been a very tough job, I think, to work out who the man of the series was. I was kind of a bit surprised that it didn't go to Cummins. I think he was the one that probably stood out to me because he set the tone at the start. And again, he missed one as well. But gee, those 2 centuries, particularly that one on day 1.
Day 1 was unbelievable.
I mean, he batted out his world considering how difficult the conditions were and how difficult everyone else found it. He came out to bat and hit everything in the middle from the word go, and just, I mean, he was breathtaking with the way he played.
A little bit of a caveat for the 5th test series syndrome, where it's just go and play, even though they're trying to win it clearly.
Would you
take a little bit off just because it's a dead series, dead rubber.
That last one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it was difficult conditions.
So.
It was exceptional to watch. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I think
there's an element of freedom that comes with that.
I agree with you, but I think, and 2 things about that. When he came in, he kind of had nothing to lose because everyone else had failed. And sort of like, oh, I'll get some quick runs. But also the thing about that is because Khawaja had got those 200s in Sydney, there was a bit of pressure on Travis to make runs because I don't think they'll continue with Khawaja opening the batting. So it was kind of like, well, if Khawaja got runs again and then Travis had missed out, then he might not have been playing in that first test in Pakistan.
Let's see what George has to say about this. Our man George, who joined us on the line for the last show of last year, and now he's on the line for the first show of this year. George, welcome.
Boys, welcome back.
Thank you, buddy. How are you?
Oh, not too bad, you know. I've got to admit, the big Greg, the B side did very well for the 6 weeks anyway.
Oh, very good.
Except for Scotty Gowan. He's a bit soft. Well, he used to get a sabbatical of every 3 weeks, and I only done 4 weeks out of the possible 6. You've got to take that into account.
Well, it's a rotation policy, George. A bit like the Australian bowling attack. We just like to give people a go.
I'll tell you what, the other fellow wasn't bad. John McFarland with the Harold Sun, he was good.
Well, Glenn was good. He's going to join us a little bit later on, too.
You know, he come up with some good ideas, you know, the top five and all that type of thing. I like that.
Oh, good, good. Do you watch the cricket, George?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, did you watch the cricket?
I did, I watched it, but I love the test cricket, but not so much the best cricket. It's too much of it. I think they have to, you know, cut it down a bit. I think it's too much. You know, 2020. But the test cricket, yes, and it was so good to see the Poms could make over 300 runs, you know.
Good point. Good point. Well, George, do you have any quaddies through the Christmas period?
No, it's too early in the year, but last year they had a very good year, but this year it's a bit early. We just take it easy, you know. Just like you people, I don't want you to rush, you know, slowly. Just take it easy, and we'll see you at the year, no problems.
No doubt, no doubt. Great to have you with us on a Monday morning, George. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. You said to say thanks. That's George, our man from Layla. Dennis in Oakley, he loves talking cricket. Hello, Dennis.
Yes, good morning, boys, and as everybody said, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, a couple of things, if I could. The English team that greets us next year, is it 23? We're going there, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. The core of their team will be Root, Archer, Wood, and Stokes. They'll be ready and waiting with what they can build around it. We will have a real battle on our hand going to England to play. They were very unlucky here in a sense. In one thing, when they came here, no one knew at all, and nor did we, someone called Scott Boland. What on earth is a Scott Boland? He is now, I've been watching cricket for 70 odd, almost 80 years now. The thing that strikes me about Boland is the full-hearted embrace by the Australian people of this young fella. It's extraordinary. I've never seen this. He is absolutely adored. And I don't know if he seems to have shown enough on different pitches. This is no fluke. He just happens to be a wonderful bowler. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but Dennis, the thing with Scott Boland is no one's taken more wickets than him at Sheffield Shield level for the last 4 or 5 years. So what it shows is the strength of Australia's first-class system, that someone like him can come up when asked, but it's got the body of work at Shield level is so strong is that there is a confidence that he'll do a very good job. And you know how big I am on the Sheffield Shield? It's such a strong competition. And when I see the likes of Boland, Nisa, Richardson getting out high-quality batsmen on a regular basis, I expect that when they go to the test level, they're going to be able to do that as well because they get out our good players. And I think there's no doubt, and half touched on this before, that the conditions suited him. Even in Sydney, I mean, we haven't seen Sydney wicket play like that ever. It was just absolutely set up for Scott to do what he did, but he just did it at incredible levels.
Thank you, Dennis. Nice to have you with us for a Monday morning talking about the world of cricket. You mentioned Mark Wood there. He's the shining light.
He's fantastic.
For them. Him and Zach Crawley, they're the two white hopes, great white hopes for the English team.
Absolutely. But we beat England 4-0 here, and then, what was it, 2-all, 1-all, whatever it was in England. It's completely different over there.
No, but at least we win a test.
Which is fine. Yeah, that's true. But what I'm saying is it's not going to be a walk in the park for us in 18 months' time.
Well, Archer makes a difference too, if he's steaming in.
Imagine if it was Wood and Archer and then Broad your third or Anderson's your third. Maybe Broad and Anderson your third and your fourth. I'm not sure why they keep playing Jack Leach. You don't need to play a spinner just because you need to play a spinner.
Mm.
The orders of the court are, one, the amended application be dismissed with costs, such costs to be agreed or failing agreement assessed. Two, reasons to be published at a later date.
That was the verdict that was handed down by the Supreme Court, the Federal Court. In fact, three judges on the bench said that, Novak, you are not to stay in Australia, let alone Victoria. Out you go. He's in Dubai. I just landed in Dubai, I think. I saw some photos on the socials. So the number one player in the world in the men's, who's looking for a career Grand Slam number 21 to break all the records, won't be doing it in Melbourne. It's been an absolute circus. Craig Gabriel has been all over it, of course, and he joins us on The Breakfast Club. Craig, good morning. Happy Australian Open to you.
Hi, guys. Good to be with you. Can you turn on some brighter weather, the heavy cloud overhead?
Hang on a second. Where have you been the last couple of weeks? It's been basically the Bahamas around here.
Yeah, I know. But this is the first day of the Australian Open. Yesterday was pretty warm.
Well, you know what? We don't have to do that. What we can keep in the cupboard for a couple of days, Craig, it seems, is the wet bulb. We don't need the bulb at the moment.
There's no wet bulb anymore. That's done and dusted, thankfully.
Now, tell us your take on proceedings. It's been a circus from start to finish, as far as I'm concerned. But I'd love to get your inside knowledge. You talk to people that make things happen in this sport, in this this realm. Tell us more about what's happened in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it has been an absolute dog's breakfast. It really has. It's been frustrating, annoying, confusing, complicated, everything. And it's been muddy and murky. And now people just want to get on with things. And yes, there have been some players who have objected incredibly strongly about the way things have gone with Djokovic, John Isner being one, Riley Opelka being another. Not that I put too much into what Riley Opelka necessarily says, but as far as the bigger names and the important ones like Rafa Nadal and Andy Murray, they've said we just need to get on with things now and accept what's happened. It hasn't been good. And that's for all of us to see. You know, obviously we can see that as plain as the noses on our faces, but it's now time to concentrate on the tennis, and they don't really want to talk about it. Stefanos Tsitsipas made that abundantly clear a day or two ago. So, you know, his comments was, it's messy, but he could have followed one path, get the vaccine. Garbine Muguruza made that very clear in Sydney as well. So a lot of the players, the majority of the players said they followed the guidelines and the rules, but Novak Djokovic decided he had his own rules and guidelines to follow.
So there was all this talk, Craig, as the decision was handed down or were about to be handed down, that what the outcome might be what we got yesterday, but there'd be an appeal and an injunction sought for Novak to actually stay and play the Australian Open. That clearly didn't happen, but there was some discussion about that. Why didn't he do that?
Well, no, because he couldn't. The government lawyers lost what I'm calling a skirmish. They were quite happy to have this ruling made by a single judge. The Djokovic lawyers wanted the full federal court, three judges, because they made the point that that would stop any further appeals. And they ended up losing the war after that. So if it had been one judge making a decision that he had to go, then they could have appealed again. And it would have dragged on, sure. But that's the way it went. And the Chief Justice handed down that decision last night, afternoon. It took everybody by surprise because the way they had been speaking during the day, they had indicated that, there could be a decision today, but they also suggested that it looked like it was going to drag into tomorrow, meaning today. So I think that's why it also took people by surprise when it actually was handed down a little before 6 o'clock last night.
Craig, we're going to speak to someone who has been covering the court case a little bit later on, so we can sort of get a bit more on that then. But just one final one from me on this. It's more for someone like you who covers tennis around the world. Mm. Is this going to have an impact on the way tennis sees Australia or tennis sees the Australian Open, or do you think it'll wash over relatively quickly?
Oh, look, he's going to have a black mark on his name and his career from now on. But I think what is being voiced a little bit more now is that tennis has got to be stronger in making a decision on these sorts of things, such as a vaccine mandate, because there are going to be tournaments where this will probably crop up, and countries are not allowing players in without full vaccinations. China is going to be one of them when those events come back online. There's an issue with American tournaments. What's the UK going to do about Wimbledon? So I think if the tours themselves say, right, this is it, no ifs or buts, I think it could make a bit more sense for a lot of these tournaments, because they then have the guidelines and the regulations stipulated by the governing body of the sport.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, and that comes just down to leadership. I know that Craig Tiley would have loved Novak Djokovic to be here because
sure,
of
everybody would,
and particularly with all the history that he could, you know, get past Nadal and Federer by winning this one. I get all of that, but strong leadership and a consistent message probably would have been the way to go. Okay, men's draw. You got Medvedev, the $2.50 tab favourite, Zverev, the second favourite, then Nadal. So we've got a men's draw without Djokovic and Federer, which doesn't usually happen. Is it Medvedev's time to sort of embrace this whole thing about being the one to beat, or because it's unfamiliar territory for him?
Well, he's a US Open champion.
But he wasn't favourite going into that event.
No, but then, you know, Djokovic, when he's playing, he's the favourite anyway.
That's right, yeah.
So everybody else is, like, just after that. But absolutely, I mean, in fact, for me, even before the saga, Medvedev and Zverev were the ones to were my picks for the title. So, you know, I think he will do it. I think it'll be fantastic for the game if Medvedev does, because people are going to see him a little bit more and appreciate what he's capable of and the personality that he is. He is an incredible individual. He's as funny as all hell. And if you remember his celebration at the U.S. Open, that was amusing, very amusing in itself. So I think he's great for the game, and, yeah, I actually want him to kick on.
All right, and then in the women's, you've got Barty favourite, $3.75, Osaka, who knows how to win down here, at $8, mm-hmm. Muguruza at $13, and then a host of players sort of between $13 and $20 at the tab. Tell us about a couple of the players that perhaps we don't know a lot about, because it's sort of changing a bit, the women's game.
Yeah, it is to a degree. I mean, Maria Sakkari, who I've spoken about on a number of occasions, you know, I want to see her getting a bit more consistent. It's happening, but it needs to happen a little bit more frequently. Paula Badosa won Sydney on the weekend. She and Vika Azarenka, for my money, played the most incredible women's match of 2021, the final of Indian Wells. She's now got confidence, and she's got Ida Tomljanovic today. So those are a couple of players. And Coco Gauff is the future of women's tennis. It's wonderful to see her play and the personality that she's got developing. So there's a lot to look out for. There really is. And you know, give it a couple of days, and I think the dust will settle, and we'll be talking of what we're supposed to be talking about at this time of the year, and that's the tennis.
The pressure on Ash is going to be immense,
yep.
Craig. We know that. And we've seen through the last decade or so that Australian favourites haven't fared well with that, haven't coped well with that. Is she a different gravy, Ash Barty?
Yeah, she is. I mean, she's been the semi-finalist.
Yeah.
Sam Stosur struggled with that attention and that pressure. She's admitted it. As much as she's tried not to have it, it's been, you know, she's found it difficult to cope. Ash is a different kettle of fish altogether, and she loves her fishing, by the way. But she's more relaxed with it all. She takes it in her stride. She accepts it, and you know, the maturity of winning a French title and a Wimbledon title and being world number one. This week, I think it's, oh, this week it could be, I think it's 104 consecutive weeks as world number one. You know, she relishes it. She loves it. And she really feeds off the Australian public. Now, she goes in looking to do the best that she can. It doesn't always work out, but I think she's the type of player from Australia that can cope with it, with the Australian Open. She's got Naomi Osaka, potentially in the fourth round.
Well, she'll certainly get the support, you'd think, from the home crowd here, even though it's not Brisbane. The Melbourne crowd will certainly get around Ash, you'd think, as the number one seed and the favourite for the women's title at the Australian Open. What about Tanasi Kokkinakis? Fantastic win in Adelaide across the weekend. Just 25 years of age still, Tanasi. You might think he'd probably be 55, the number of tournaments he's missed through the last couple of years, but he's only 25 still and seemingly in career best form after his maiden ATP title.
Absolutely love it. I mean, he is looking so fit and healthy and relaxed and just having a good time. And that is so big, such a big deal for somebody who's been through what he's been through and well documented. I mean, when he was starting, he came through juniors, he came through with Nick. Kyrgios. They play doubles together. They refer to each other as their bros. And, you know, he was just hit with so many injuries. And now to be able to get that sort of consistency going is going to be huge for Thanas. And he's 103 on the rankings now after that win. So it's a big step. And fingers crossed, he gets a bit more of that under his belt, and he'll be flying, and no more injuries.
On you, Scotty. What do we say to you in season 1994?
Keep punching, Drew.
That's the way, old son, you beauty.
That's the way, old son, you beauty. Two of the greats, Drew Morfitt and Scott Palmer, sadly both no longer with us, but a wonderful tribute paid in the Herald Sun and online by Scott and Palmer's very, very dear friend, Glenn McFarlane, of course, a team member on the Summer Breakfast crew around here on RSN 927. And we thought we'd get him on because it was worthwhile celebrating the life of someone so influential in the world of media and football in these parts. Macca, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning, Half and Whitey. How are you? A sad day, but 84 years, I'm not too sure many people packed as much into their life as Scotty Palmer did in his 84 years.
I loved one of your lines early doors in the piece, Mackie. You said, for generations of Melbournians, Scotty and Palmer's punchlines were as much a part of their Sunday fare as World of Sport was in its halcyon years or Mum's Roast. And I reckon you're absolutely on the money. He became a phenomenon, didn't he?
He really did. And the first of the real multimedia personalities in footy. And he sort of paved the way for so many going forward, really, in a sense. He had the great punchlines that he did, and we devoured them on the Saturday, on the Sunday morning. And he used to like to think that people would devour them at night. They'd wait all day and then they'd have one with a little nightcap at night. But we also know that he was brilliant on the TV as well with Channel 7 with punchlines and also with 3UZ RSN.
Yes.
He was the breakfast host for a number of years as well, and he loved the radio side of things as well.
Yeah, I didn't know that till I read the piece, that he was part of the family around these parts, but that was nice to read. I did. You talk about his performances on the Saturday replay and all the news and the Palmer's punchlines there. Keep punching. I did hear a story yesterday, Macca, that perhaps he wasn't as smooth all the time with his delivery, and that one episode, in fact, took 27 takes.
Yeah. There were a couple of records there. Sounds like me in my early days. Well, I was a bit more than that. But, yeah, Scotty, there was the great tradition of when he first started, Gordon Bennett said to him, you know, we need to jazz up the big replay and get some more news on there. And it seemed pretty natural that Scotty would take punchlines there. And they used to have a thing called Scotty Lotto. The cameraman and the producers would try and work out how many takes. And they actually betted, you know, they were actually able to have a bet on it as well. And in the end, when it got to 27 takes, Scotty goes, nah, let's go live with this. So it started then to go live. And I know that, you know, everyone loved it so much. He had some absolute crackers, guys. And I think the beauty of it was that he was so natural. And the day that he said that Ron Barassi's barber was prepared to sign an Afro David to declare that Ron didn't dye his hair. And then we had the beauty of Kerry McKernahan pinging a hamstring, and we weren't sure whether it was Wayne Carey, Corey McKernan, or Stephen Kernahan. So that was the beauty of Scotty. He got the message across in the most unique way, and his mum was a Tivoli showgirl, and so Scotty loved performing, and that was, you know, his dad was a famous journo who, you know, was there when Squizzy Taylor died, and
yeah.
And of course Scotty and his son Lincoln were actually, when they had the Cherry Tree Hotel, were actually held at gunpoint by the drug lord Dennis Allen for a couple of hours before he got out of that little scrape. And so he was an ultimate performer, guys, and the TV was absolutely extraordinary. I think Mark Stevens nearly ended it one time because when he was a production editor there, all the boys in the sub-editors, or the mechanics, as Scotty called them, they used to shift pot plants, and one guy, in a sense, in the end, walked past with a pot plant on his head, live on television, and they go, we'll just take the boys out of the... But Scotty was unmissable on a Saturday night on the TV, and then in this paper on... He helped promote Sunday newspapers. It's hard to believe that in the 70s and, you know, in the 70s and 80s, like the Sunday newspaper was strong, but when it really became big, Scotty was the one who turned it into the big Sunday newspaper.
What made him such a good journo, Glenn? I mean, we often talk about whether it's the contacts you had or just the news sense. What was it for him that stood out so much?
Yeah, great question, Whitey. I think what it was, the contacts were crucial, absolutely crucial. He had a contact book that he could ring the Prime Minister. He was on you know, very close terms with Bob Hawke when Bob Hawke was Prime Minister. He had the best contact book in town. But he had a couple of catchphrases. You never get a story in a milk bar, which meant that you had to get out and about. And you've got to go to a pub, or you've got to go to a footy ground, or you've got to press the flesh, he used to like to say as well. His other great line was, where there's smoke, there's blue cod. So in that sense, if there was a sniff of a story, Scotty reckoned there was a story, and he would get to the bottom of it to the nth degree. And, boys, he would make, I reckon, he probably kept Telstra or whatever it was before that in business for so many years. He would have made 200 calls a day and taken 200 calls a day. Having sat there and watched and worked with him for 20 years and lucky enough to be mentored by him for 30-odd, even to having a last conversation with him, at the start of last week, he just had this thirst for knowledge and thirst for the story, and I think that was the beauty of Scotty.
It's an interesting conversation, probably for another time, Glenn, about the change of how a journalist gets their stories. I mean, now you've got WhatsApp and text messages and all those direct messages and all these sorts of things which can help sort of, I guess, construct a story to a point. But back in the day, it was you either met those people in a pub or at a footy ground, or it was just purely done by phone calls, and that's how you develop relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
And trust.
Yeah, and this is before mobile phones. Like, this is really, yeah. Most of it was before mobile phones. So Scotty had to get out and about in his office. I remember one day, like, he wrote some incredible stories. St Kilda's move to Moorabbin, Tom Hafey sat in. He was really close mates with Tom Hafey. Gary Ablett on TV, he broke the first retirement of Gary Ablett with thanks to Glenn Quatermain, who helped him out. But I remember, guys, one day, this is getting out on the job, 1993 pre-season, he rushes out of the office, and I said to him, Scotty, where are you going, mate? Like, he goes, I'm going out to North Melbourne, training session at Bulleen. I went, well, pre-season, Scotty, what are you doing that for? He goes, Shimmer's about to find out he's going to get sacked. So he knew, before Shimmer knew, that he was going to get sacked, and he broke the story as well in that one. It was incredible that he had incredible sources, but he wanted to be on the spot when the story broke.
And that's it. It's all over. Australia win in Hobart. They win the fifth test, and more importantly, they win this Ashes series 4-0.
Let's be honest, it was a smacking. There were the closing moments on Fox Sports yesterday as Australia rounded out the series 4-0, as you heard from Brendan Julian there on Fox Sports. It was a clinic and a capitulation of embarrassing proportions by England yesterday, all out for 56 when they lost their first wicket to collapse like a few others have done before them. Alex Doolan, I wonder what he was thinking about all that. A Tassie cricket legend, former Australian Test cricketer as well. He's been good enough to join us on the line. Alex, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Great to have you with us on a Monday morning after an emphatic series result and an amazing test result. So what was your take on proceedings in the last 3 days?
Yeah, well, it was a lot to digest in the last 3 days, wasn't it? It all happened so quickly. Firstly, I thought it was a hugely exciting game of cricket. I know it only went for 3 days, but those 3 days were jam-packed with momentum shifts and good balls and some good batting, some bad batting. It was all happening in those 3 days. So exciting test, but Australia for the most part dominated it.
As a competitor, when you see a team who's clearly broken spirit and lacking some talent and quality collapse like they did, what do you think when that happens, when we got them all out for 56 effectively from the first wicket falling yesterday?
Well, it was very disappointing for the contest. Like I said, I thought for the first 2.5 days it had been really competitive. I mean, England jumped out of the box and had Australia 3 for 12. Then Australia fought back, and then we lost our wickets, and yeah, it just kept jumping back and forward. So, and then again on that day three, when England were none for 63, I think they were. I thought, ooh, geez, are there a sniff here?
Yeah.
And then yeah, it all went awry for them after that. But yeah, I guess it summed up the series a little bit. I thought Australia have been way too classy for England the entire series, and you know, they deserved a whitewash, I thought. If it hadn't been for a bit of weather in Sydney, Australia deserved that whitewash.
We're keen to have a chat to you, Alex, just more than anything else, because of the fact you're a Tasmanian and there was an Ashes test played at Hobart. How proud of you were you when you got to experience that whole thing of an Ashes at Hobart?
Yeah, I guess the significance probably hasn't really sunk in yet. I mean, we've just watched an Ashes series, the biggest test series in the world on our home soil, which has never been done before. I was incredibly proud with the way everything went for the game. I thought the crowd turned up. There was a huge and awesome vibe around the ground. It was really buzzing for the 10,000 people, I think, that arrived each day. I mean, they made a huge contribution to the quality of the game. I thought Cricket Tasmania and the staff put on a really good show. I thought the wicket was really good. I know it only lasted 3 days, but I think there was more to that than just the quality of the wicket. Just hugely proud. I mean, this was a historic moment for Tasmanian sport, and I was really proud to be able to be there and witness it.
Yeah, I think even just the significance of them lifting the Ashes and above the head in Hobart, I think is something that, you know, will never be able to be taken away from Hobart. Just on the pitch, because it looked like something we'd see in New Zealand with the greenness to it. You've batted at Belrive so many times. Can you explain to our listeners what it's like where it looks a lot worse than how it actually plays?
Yeah, well, that was a pretty typical Tasmanian Belrive wicket, really. I mean, I've played on a lot greener wickets than that at Belrive as well that seemed to be quite impossible to play. I thought one of the telling factors in the game was just the twilight period each night. Mm. So the wicket did a little bit, which it's allowed to do on day one, and England jumped out of the blocks and had us 3 for 12, but Travis Head showed that you could bat on it, and Cameron Green as well. So it was a really typical pitch. I just thought each night around that twilight period, that's when things really started to accelerate, and we saw lots of wickets, and then once a wicket fell, it was really hard to come and start in the dark.
What was the story of the series for you, Alex? We had obviously Scott Boland from a bowling perspective come in and do some remarkable things in the last three tests. Travis Head was named as the player of the series. And we saw Mark Wood put on a really spirited performance for England, probably one of the only ones that did so. What was the standout story for you?
There were a few. Scotty Boland was definitely one of those. I was really happy to see Scott do what he was able to do, and not surprised either. He's been doing that for Victoria for a long, long time on a very flat MCG wicket, and he's been able to have success. So he was one story. I thought Pat Cummins as captain was outstanding to take the reins as a fast bowler and a young man still to lead the team as well as he did, not only on the field, but his own performances as well were exceptional, which is, as captain, that can be something that's really challenging as a fast bowler too. I thought Travis Head's batting, he really took that number five spot and made it his own, really. When there was a lot of conjecture around who was going to take that number five spot, would it be Head or Khawaja? I thought, Head really repaid the faith of the selectors. And probably one thing that I thought was a huge part of the whole series was just the quality of cricket wicket that we had in Australia this year, this summer. I thought there were a lot more bowler-friendly wickets than there had been in the past, and that made for some really exciting cricket.
Gab Pound about to join us from the Blues. You'd love Gab Pound, Whitey, because she wears a long sleever. Long sleeve wear.
Way to play football.
And in the navy blue jumper of the Mighty Carlton Football Club.
Special.
They look like super people.
They do.
Is what they do. And she was in super form on Saturday night as the Blues got their first win against the Cats in the AFLW season. She joins us on the line. Hello, Gab.
The Breakfast Club.
That's correct. What do you think?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, great. I'm good.
How are you going, you two?
Yeah, we're going very well. How are you going? Do you feel like Superwoman when you wear that navy blue long sleever?
Yeah, it feels pretty good. I think, Superwoman's probably the right one.
Well, it's not a bad one to open up with. Hey, a good result in the end for the Blues on the weekend after a disappointing outcome the previous week against the Magpies. The monkey off the back, is that a factor?
Yeah, I think so. From last year, those two losses at the start hurt a fair bit. So, yeah, getting a win round two is pretty sweet to start off with.
What about the fact that it was a late change to proceedings and that we didn't know who would be playing it up until Thursday night, well, the last night of training, but we put it all together in a couple of days. How do you go sitting with that?
Well, Haas, as one of your favourite quotes, everything is subject to change. So we're cool with it. It's fine. Give us anything and we'll roll with it.
I want to go a little bit sort of further into that, not just, I mean, who you're going to play, but the whole thing around the uncertainty of COVID. It's still unfortunately lingering around. As an athlete like yourself, how difficult is that to sort of navigate, just from your mind more than anything else?
Yeah, well, Manu's told me, at training, and it was almost, judging from the last two years of COVID, it just wasn't a surprise to me personally. So it didn't really affect me that much. So I was happy to drive down the road instead of jumping on the plane and coming back late at night. So, I'm happy to, roll with the punches, and that's how you play football as well. Like, it's not always perfect. So it's always a bit of bash and crash, and who knows what's going to happen. So I kind of like that, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a good way of looking at it. But what have you done to your life from a sacrifice point of view to stay out of trouble? I mean, do you avoid restaurants? Do you avoid going to the shopping centres, particularly during the sales time? Or do you just lead a normal life and what happens, happens?
I've avoided shopping centres. I don't really like them anyway. There's a lot of people. I've been avoiding restaurants and all of that, but still having some sort of social life, hanging out with friends and doing all that kind of stuff. So I'm not that sterile, but the social life aspect is still really important to me. So that's the kind of climate we're in at the moment. I guess if it does happen, you're pretty unlucky to get it. It is what it is once it does happen.
Well, one of the companions through the summer these days in the world of sport is the Big Bash. And this year's edition, as we heard with Quinny, has seen the Perth Scorchers doing their thing at the top of the ladder. But down the bottom, it's been a very sad tale for my boys, the Melbourne Renegades. Aaron Finch is a part of that crew. He's had a big year, T20 World Cup winning captain, but it's not going well at the moment at the Gades. He joins us on the line to wrap it up for us. Finchy, good morning.
Morning, guys. How are you?
We're going all right, mate. My heart's hurting just a little bit, being a Renegades man. Can you ease my pain?
Yeah, mine too. It's been a difficult year. It hasn't been a great year for a lot of people, but for the Renegades, we've been close a few times. We've been a long way off a few times, but it's been disappointing.
What's it been? Have you been able to put your finger on how and why it's got to this point?
Oh, I think there's a mix of inexperience in there. There's obviously some times that we haven't taken our chances in games, which is disappointing. I mean, we've trained hard. We're doing everything that we can off the field. We're just haven't quite made that transition into taking the great opportunities when they present them in games. And in T20 cricket in particular, good teams don't present opportunities to win games all that often, and we just haven't been able to take them, unfortunately.
Well, there's not too many voices in cricket that you listen to more about T20 cricket, the way that you've played it through the Big Bash and, of course, the international level as well. Is the Big Bash evolving? Is it a different competition than it was two or three years ago? Do you need different strengths?
Oh, I think that you just need to be consistent, which is one thing that we haven't been, but it is a slightly different game to what it is in international cricket because of the rule differences. You've got the four-over power play at the start, then you've got the power surge throughout, and I think there's been some times that we might have been, I think if you're chasing a big score and you're a couple down early, then you're probably looking at the bash boost point before anything else, and then because the game might have slipped away from you a little bit, and that can go one way or another pretty quick, and we've probably been on the wrong side of trying a little bit too hard in that regard as well.
How have you found it, Aaron? I mean, it's been an incredible time for you. You had the T20 World Cup. You came back. You had a bit of a break. You've got a sore knee. At times, I'm worried at watching you in the field that you're not even close to 100% fit, but you're trying to get the Renegades up and firing. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm going okay, mate. It's been a whirlwind, actually, with first baby here.
Yeah.
Like you said, the T20 World Cup, that was pretty amazing. So to be able to come back after that and have a little bit of time to spend with Amy and Esther has been pretty special, actually. So that's amazing.
Is your leg okay?
No, it's not bad.
Doesn't sound awesome.
That's not 100%, I'll be honest, but yeah, a few anti-inflammes and painkillers keep getting me through. So I think at times you're never 100%, but that's just one of those things. I'm getting towards the end, so I want to play as much as I can.
Yeah, and I guess too with the Renegades, you touched on it before, you've got that top end with yourself and Sean and Kane Richardson particularly, but it is the young group, and a lot of Victoria's best young players do wear red when it comes to this time of year. What have you liked from that next generation coming through?
Oh, I think the way that they train is amazing. They give everything, and the talent is absolutely there. So it just comes down to getting probably a little bit more match experience and the ability for them to keep playing against some very, very good players consistently. I think will hold them in good stead going forward. But, yeah, youngsters, they don't play as much as probably what they used to with the amount of cricket that you miss with Big Bash and stuff like that. They probably miss a decent chunk of club cricket. It's not ideal, but I think the way that they train is unbelievable.
Because I wanted to talk to you about that, because you've mentioned this on the coverage about momentum in the Big Bash League. Once you've got it, it's hard to sort of lose it, and if you don't have it, it's hard to kind of get it. And as guys go through some form dips, you can't go back and play on a Saturday for your Premier Cricket Club. You've got to find form out in the middle, and I can imagine for younger players particularly, that can be difficult.
Yeah. T20 can be a brutal game at times, especially when it's not going your way, because you've got to take risks early in your innings as a batter, and when they don't come off, it can be really difficult to find yourself to be able to pull the trigger and take that risk when you need to, and it can be really difficult. So I think guys just need to keep playing and playing, to be honest.
Well, there's playing and playing for another two games for the Renegades to round out the season. It's been one of those seasons, Finchie, where it's been all over the shop a little bit, home games, interstate and all that sort of stuff because of the environment we're in. Are you sick of all that yet?
Oh, I think everyone is, mate, to be honest. The way that, well, not playing or shuffling around to the schedule, it's just being locked down and bubbles and hubs and stuff, that can be, that wears you down more than anything. So I reckon that plays on people's minds a lot more than probably what gets given credit for. So, it'll be nice when that's over.
And what happens for you after that? What do you get a chance to chill out?
I hope so. I think it's straight. It's continued with the protocols that we're currently under, and then the ODI series against New Zealand. So, I don't think there's too much of a break, to be honest, which would be nice to be able to get a couple of days out of it, to be fair.
Well, tomorrow night, the Hurricanes, you're the away team at Marvel Stadium against the Hurricanes. That's not a bad result. And then the MCG on Wednesday night against the Thunder to finish off the campaign for the Renegades. No finals action this year. What about the Test Series? Can I get your attention to that for a second? And more on the leadership of Pat Cummins thrust into that position after the whole Tim Payne situation, which we won't need to go into, but walked into it under a fair bit of fire, albeit with a really strong team against an underqualified opponent, it seems, as we've learnt in the last five tests. How do you think that he managed himself, Paddy, coming throughout all this?
Oh, he was amazing. The way that he leads the team, the way that he carries himself is outstanding, and he's got nothing but respect from every single player out there. So he'll do a wonderful job for a long time. Great bloke to have it at the helm of Australian cricket.
He keeps talking about having fun. It seems to be a bit of a theme with him as captain. And I know you're much the same when you're captaining the shorter form. Do you work together to get that consistency or the continuity between the way you lead and the way, say, the tests are led, or is it a completely different situation?
Oh, we don't talk about how each other's going to lead as such, but you have the common ground that you want to achieve sort of at the top, and you try and both work together to make sure that everything's aligned and you're making good decisions along the way. And he did a fantastic job throughout the summer, and we speak quite regularly about what it looks like from a white ball and a red ball point of view. But at the end of the day, it comes down to how each individual wants to run their team. And, yeah, he's done a brilliant job, and Australian cricket's in a great position if he's at the top.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.